from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, the most recent Israeli offensive in Gaza began its eighth day today, marked by escalating rhetoric and violence on both sides, despite international pleas for peace and an Egyptian proposed ceasefire. According to Palestinian officials, over 180 people have been killed in Gaza, most of them civilians. Meanwhile, Israel says close to 1,000 rockets have been fired from Gaza. We'll discuss the latest developments in the ongoing conflict. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Following the murder of three young Israeli students and an apparent revenge killing by Israelis of a young Palestinian, multiple airstrikes and artillery fire was set off with Israeli action against Hamas in Gaza under the codename Operation Protective Edge. And hundreds of volleys of rockets have been fired from Gaza onto Israel. Nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed and over 1,200 wounded, while the Iron Dome anti-missile system has served to protect Israeli lives, though as the conflict has escalated, a drone ultimately was shot down in midair by Israel, fired by Hamas into Israel. Some 40,000 Israeli reservists were mobilized and on the verge of establishing a possible ground war when the Egyptian government, under Egyptian leader General Al-Sisi, proposed a ceasefire, which was supposed to begin today. It was accepted by the Israeli cabinet, rejected by Hamas, and the violence has flared once again. We want to update you on the ongoing crisis in this hour and provide analysis of it. And joining us from Jerusalem is BBC correspondent Nawal Assad, and we welcome you to the program, Nawal Assad. Good to have you. Good morning.
You're welcome. Good morning.
I'd like to begin by asking the Egyptian proposal is simply dead in the water now. It would appear that that is the case. Is there any ongoing discussion? Is there any hope that it will be resurrected?
Yeah, basically, it did not work. The Israel Security Cabinet agreed to the Egyptian ceasefire proposal just at 9 o'clock this morning, which was the deadline for agreeing a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel to stop for the cessation of hostilities. Now, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came after that and warned Hamas if it rejected the Egyptian plan, then Israel would continue and it would intensify its military operation. 6 hours after 9 o'clock, Hamas did not stop, launching rockets at Israel. The Israeli army, that by now Hamas had launched 80 rockets basically into Israeli areas. 6 hours after 9 o'clock Jerusalem time, the Israeli military also started raiding Gaza with the same kind of scenes that we have seen before. So the deal did not really work.
It didn't work, we're being at least told, from Hamas's point of view, because they wanted essentially to have the border more available to them, and the border which is closed.
Yeah, Hamas's main point is there is a need to ease the situation in the Gaza Strip. Gaza, as you know, has been under a blockade from Israel for the past 7 years. And although many leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad rejected the ceasefire offer from Egypt, but they were saying that they are looking into it, but they wanted more meat on that Egyptian offer. And they said they did not want to enter into a ceasefire with Israel without knowing what proposals exactly Israel wants to make, especially that there are many Israeli leaders who are saying that Hamas must be demilitarized, as the economy, for instance, Israeli economy minister put it. He said that he wanted Hamas to dismantle all of its launchers, rockets, weapons, and this is the way they want to reach a deal with Hamas. Hamas believes that this is going to leave the organization and leave also, in their own views, that it would leave people of the Gaza Strip unable to protect themselves from what they view Israel as their enemy. Now, there is a lack of trust, obviously, between the two parties. Israel considered the quick acceptance of the ceasefire as an opportunity for Hamas to stop hostilities and to stop harming Israeli civilians by the continuous rockets that they launch on Israeli areas, and also to stop, according to them, to give Hamas a chance to stop the killing, you know, the killing of Palestinians caused by Israeli raids, which they blame on Hamas itself, because they say that Hamas is using houses, institutions for launching these rockets. Hamas, of course, refuses that, and they want a deal that guarantees an easing of the economical situation in Gaza. Now, there is a serious humanitarian situation in Gaza prior to this conflict, because for the past 7 years, Gaza had been blockaded. There is a huge shortage of medication, food. People are unable to cross to any other country because they cannot enter Israel, and they cannot go to Egypt many times because of the Rafah crossing that you probably keep hearing about. The name keeps cropping up, the Rafah crossing. It is the only exit for people in Gaza into the outside world. They cannot go except to Israel, and that's closed, and they can go to Egypt only through the Rafah crossing. Hamas wants these crossings, especially the Rafah crossing, to be eased. Now, the problem with Egypt during the past year, that Hamas had a very close relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who took power there a year ago. A year ago, who took power up until a year ago, when Mohamed Morsi, who was the elected president in Egypt, who was a member, who was part of the Muslim Brotherhood there, was ousted by the current president, who was elected again a few months ago to become the Egyptian president, who loathed the Muslim Brotherhood and who vowed he deemed them basically a terrorist organization. So the relationship between Egypt and Hamas became a very bad relationship. So there is even a problem of trust, not only between Israel and Hamas, there is a problem of trust between Hamas and Egypt, who was traditionally the broker of any truce between Israel and Hamas. Whenever one of these wars broke out, there is a trend of, you know, conflict between Israel and Hamas. There was in 2008, 2012, and there is this time as well. Many voices in Israel says we do not want a ceasefire that would break out again after a year or two with more rockets landing on the south of Israel, especially, which stops people from having normal lives. And also a lot of, you know, Israelis say that they want, actually, Lieberman suggested today, the Israeli foreign minister suggested reoccupying the Gaza Strip, was something that other ministers, including the Meretz chairman Galon, criticized him heavily for suggesting, and said this is against what the Israeli strategy is about. I met earlier today as well a member of the Israel Jewish Home Party, who she was actually criticized by the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, describing her having very extreme ideas. She said to me, and her party rejected the ceasefire deal during the meeting of the Israeli cabinet this morning. She said to me that the only way that any solution can happen is to dismantle Hamas weapon arsenal. But she, interestingly, she added that she does not want Hamas to finish militarily, they don't want Hamas to finish politically, but they want them to finish militarily. Now, the dilemma is for Hamas, if they finish militarily, they are finished politically as well.
Well, you talked about splits. I mean, there's splits between the military wing of Hamas and the political wing of Hamas. And it's ironic that we see brokering from Egypt, because, as you've also intimated, I think right at this point, The leadership of Egypt under al-Sisi is looked upon by Hamas as perhaps more antipathetic than Israel even, or vice versa. Thank you for joining us. Noel Assad is BBC correspondent and joined us from Jerusalem. I appreciate very much your being with us on this forum program as we continue to talk about the Israel-Gaza proposed ceasefire, which apparently at this point is not moving forward. Let me tell you who else is joining us for the hour. Janine Zakaria is here in studio with us. She's visiting lecturer at Stanford and is former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And we'll also say good morning to Robert Dineen, who's senior fellow for Middle East and African Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, joins us this morning from the nation's capital. Welcome, Robert Dineen.
Great to be with you.
Good to have you, and also good to have Nicholas Pelham, who is a correspondent with The Economist. He's with us this morning also from Jerusalem, and he's the author of A New Muslim Order. Welcome, Nicholas Pelham.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. Let me begin with Janine Zakaria, who again is here with us in studio. Hamas, we just heard from Noel Assad, certainly has built up, apparently, its arsenal, more long-range missiles, possibly drones or the specter of drones. And at this point, demilitarization of Hamas would seem to be almost just a pipe dream.
Well, it's certainly what the Israelis want, but it's not something – they've been talking about demilitarizing Hamas, I think, since 1997. So it's not something that they've been able to achieve. Here's the bottom line, Michael. Israel has the strongest military in the region, backed by the strongest military in the world, and they do not have a military answer for this problem. And we know this now, obviously, because, as Noel pointed out, we've seen several rounds of Israel trying to take out these launchers and these rockets from the air to restore what Bibi Netanyahu calls the quote-unquote sustainable quiet to Israeli cities. This is just a short-term tactical victory he's going to be able to win here. They have brought in tens of thousands of rockets, much longer range, as you mentioned, since the last offensive in November 2012. When they fired that drone yesterday, the Israelis were stunned. So their intelligence is still limited on what they've actually got there.
And you got rockets that are able to reach Haifa, at least.
Pretty much anywhere in Israel. I mean, the fact that you had sirens going off in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, even if some landed in the West Bank, as far away as the West Bank, Haifa, this has been, a stunning display, given that you've had in place this blockade over the last 7 years meant to prevent these kinds of rockets from being imported. So even despite the blockade, despite repeated small incursions into the Gaza Strip that Israel does periodically to try and push back the rocket fire, and all of this, you still have Hamas's capabilities improving.
How are they getting in, do you think?
Smuggled through the tunnels and underground, mostly, some by ship. Sometimes you see Israel intercept some of these ships and they do a big press conference about it. Now, one thing by having the Egyptian President al-Sisi is that apparently the Israelis say he's done a pretty good job at trying to crack down and destroy some of these tunnels. So maybe they won't be able to import as many, and certainly this week of operations has destroyed a great many of them. But they still have quite an arsenal, and they've proven time and again that they are able to replenish.
What is the strategy, as you see it, of Benjamin Netanyahu here? I mean, is he trying to some say he's trying to marginalize his national unity government, or he's angry because of UN recognition, that he's also essentially shoring up his own political strength.
Bibi Netanyahu, and I've covered him for a long time, he's first of all a masterful politician. He thinks of everything politically first. That's the first thing you need to know about him. Secondly, he's only can think tactically. So in other words, his goal is limited, just to restore the quiet. What his strategy is for the coming hours or days or for the coming decades for the country of Israel is unclear. Just look at what he's doing in terms of the targeting. He's taking out or trying to take out certain Hamas officials like the Hamas police chief and then kills 18 people and his family around him. But he's leaving in place Ismail Haniyeh, the chief political leader of Hamas. He is not trying to take down Hamas, right? He just wants them to have, see if you can follow, enough capabilities to fight off more radical Islamist groups in the Gaza Strip, but not enough capabilities to threaten Israel. So he has not articulated really what the strategy is. But overall, this, as hard as it is for Israelis right now with the rockets, is the preferred route for him, because the only alternative, there's two. One, a full-scale ground invasion of the Gaza Strip, which he will not do. And because there is no way, even if Avigdor Lieberman, the rightist politician in Israel, is advocating that, the public will not do it politically. Or second, he's got to go and try and do a deal with the Palestinians, a political deal that requires concessions that he's not willing to make.
Let me bring Robert Dineen into this. And Robert Dineen is Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. How much of this siege that's going on has to do, Robert Dineen, with the failure of the peace talks, or for that matter, with the unity between Fatah and Hamas?
Well, thank you. I think in the first instance, the failure of the American brokered peace effort, I think, helped create an environment of even greater despair on the ground, especially amongst Palestinians. And that's what contributed ultimately to the creation of the National Unity Government. And I think it is actually the National Unity Government that one has to think of the context has formed the context for what's happening inside Palestinian politics right now, and ultimately helps explain what Hamas is doing. Hamas and Fatah reached a National Unity Government understanding in April of this year. It was a desperate move for Hamas. They effectively accepted that the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas and the Fatah Party would return to Gaza. And indeed, Hamas agreed to relinquish some of its ministries, but they expected a few things in return. One of them, and most importantly, was some relief. There's been a fundamental strategic change in the environment for Hamas, and that has to do with the overturn last July in Egypt of the Muslim Brotherhood government. You now have a government in Egypt that considers Hamas, in essence, an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood and an implacable enemy. And as Jeanine pointed out, the government in Egypt has been working very hard now to close the tunnels. And this coming from Sinai into Gaza, effectively the only real route for goods, for money, for illicit items, really the lifeline, not just for weapons, but all sorts of goods. Egypt has taken unprecedented steps to close those tunnels, and Hamas has really felt the pain from that. So they hope that the National Unity Government with Fatah would help alleviate some of the pressure. One of the things they expected was that over 40,000 employees would receive now their salaries from the PA, from Fatah. And over the last 2 months, even since the National Unity Agreement, none of that money has been forthcoming. So Hamas has been in a position where they felt like they paid a high political price. They relinquished power in Gaza. They relinquished ministries. And yet they were not feeling relief in any way for it. And so in that context, when they then were put on the defensive because of the killing of the three Israeli yeshiva students in the West Bank, Israel conducted very heavy operations in the West Bank. I was there at the time, very much put Hamas on the defensive, identified Hamas for it. Hamas leadership in Gaza said, no, we're not responsible, which was an unusual denunciation or rather just rejection of their responsibility for a terrorist attack. And so now they felt they had no more choice. There had been missiles coming out of Gaza for the last few weeks prior to that that were being launched by Islamic Jihad. Israel expected Hamas to keep Jihad in restrained. And at that point, I think Hamas felt they had nothing left to lose. And why should they be restrain Islamic Jihad, allow Islamic Jihad to be the vanguard of resistance? And instead, they joined the fight and they started lobbing rockets. What's really interesting now, and is really the developments over the last 24 hours with this Egyptian proposal and Hamas's effective rejection of it. I don't want to hog up the line here, but I think we can get into that in our discussion.
Well, actually, let me bring Nicholas Pelham into this, correspondent for The Economist and author of A New Muslim Order. We've been talking about Hamas's rejection largely in terms of not getting what it wants from Egypt, and Egypt really looking at Hamas as a kind of, well, not a kind of, but really an enemy. But there are other factors involved here as well. I mean, at this point, what we're reading is that people in Gaza are certainly really fed up with what this onslaught has been to them, loss of so many lives. And obviously, Israelis, although they've been protected by the Iron Dome, are also fed up with this. So what kind of pressure is being brought to bear on leaders here?
I think it's certainly the case that that nerves are beginning to fray on both sides. Most Israelis do have a place to seek shelter when the sarin goes. That's not the same in Gaza. The way the exits from Gaza are all closed. There's no way out through to Egypt. There's no way out through to Israel. They're largely shut behind cement walls. And there's no sarin when...
Nick Pelham, we've got a bad line here. Let me see if we can get a better line. I'd like to have you back with us. In fact, I hope we can get you back with us on a better line. But that was sounding a little bit obscured, and to my ear, probably not as acceptable as listeners would like, or frankly, as I would like. Let me go back, if I may, to you, Janine Zakaria. There is a sense of, as I said, both peoples being under siege, and to a great extent, that must be part of the calculus here, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting how each side is framing this as a defensive war, right? When each side is launching projectiles at each other, right? You have to get into the psychology of both sides here. And, I mean, what's absent, as I mentioned...
It's more than defensive. I mean, actually, the way they're positioning it seems to me, and to a great extent, it's held up by what we've been told of those who are observing and monitoring it. On the one hand, the Israelis have been fired upon without any warnings and without any real sense of concern over civilian populations, just kind of recklessly and randomly. But nobody's been killed. So you have the other side saying nobody's been killed and we are being under siege here and we're being killed. And from their perspective, the Israelis are just hitting them indiscriminately. But the Israelis are saying we're putting out warnings and so forth. And also they're using the mosques and the schools as shields. So from both sides, there's as there has been all along, this totally conflicting narrative.
Yeah, it's very hard to sift through, especially if you haven't been on the ground there. But look, I mean, basically, we have to look towards getting past this, because if nothing changes, right, if we have a ceasefire, you're going to have a ceasefire in the next couple of days, whether it's this Egyptian version or another. I think we're missing in a weird way, Mohamed Morsi, the former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. Israel is in a weird way missing him, because he had the power to deliver Hamas in these kinds of moments. But you need to sort of say, okay, well, what are we going to do beyond this? I mean, probably what's going to happen is Israel will buy itself another 18 months of quiet for the reasons I mentioned earlier. There's no broad new thinking. The only thing that I saw that was new this week was Shaul Mofaz, the former Israeli defense minister, saying, okay, let's give $50 billion in development aid to Gaza in exchange for Hamas demilitarizing. Like, let's incentivize it a little bit. Let's do something a little different. On Hamas's side, there are things that they want, as Rob Dineen pointed out, that, you know, Israel and Egypt could give them if they wanted to, right? I'm of the viewpoint that there was perhaps a missed opportunity for Israel here for some new thinking with the unity government. What you've been doing of trying to isolate Hamas, starve them out, oust them through the blockade, it's not working, right? So what have you got to lose by trying something else? Make this Palestinian President Abbas's problem. Let him try and do something, right? So it's not clear to me how this is going to play out in terms of the immediate ceasefire, but certainly the clashing narratives are difficult to sift through.
Well, let me bring in our listeners and find out what they have to say, and you are certainly welcome to join us. In fact, let me give you the toll-free number to do that now. Our toll-free number available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, it's 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you have immediately onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We talked earlier with Noel Assad, a BBC correspondent, with us for the hour. Janine Zakaria here in studio, visiting lecturer at Stanford and former Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. Robert Dineen, senior fellow for Middle East and African Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The most recent Israeli offensive in Gaza began its eighth day today, and there is escalating rhetoric as well as more violence on both sides. This is despite international pleas for peace and what was an attempt at a brokered by Egypt ceasefire, which was to start today. The Israeli Security Cabinet accepted it, as we heard earlier from BBC correspondent Nawal Assad. At the 9 o'clock deadline, Hamas has not accepted it, and so the rockets continue to rain upon Israel, and the Well, this aerial attacks and really air and sea and land hits from Israel continue. We're talking with Robert Dineen, who is Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, and Janine Zakaria, who's here in studio with us, now a visiting lecturer at Stanford, former Jerusalem Bureau Chief and Middle East Correspondent for The Washington Post. And Robert Dineen, we were actually talking off air, that is Janine and I, about just how much of a regional conflict this is now. I mean, there are rockets also coming from southern Lebanon and from Syria. Rockets have been fired. So Israel's getting it from all sides, and certainly Hamas and Gaza's being hit unsparingly, I mean, relentlessly. And so Janine says that they're bound to come to a ceasefire, but I guess the question is when?
Yes. Well, I think you're right. I mean, there have been rockets fired from Lebanon into Israel, although I think that there have been few in numbers, and I think it was not Hezbollah was not responsible for that. I'd be surprised at this point if Hezbollah wades into this. They have their hands full in Syria right now, and they know, as do all people in Lebanon, that Israel will go in very heavily into Lebanon if the rockets fire from a second front there. I hope Janine is right that a ceasefire is likely to come forward in the next few days. But I have to tell you, I'm not sure I see it. What Hamas has done is effectively really rejected an Egyptian approach that offered them very little. It shows that the Egyptians were willing to play a reluctant role, but they weren't willing to get too far out in front. They didn't want necessarily Hamas to come out with any political benefits from this crisis. And so, in essence, they offered them a term which was basic terms which were returned to the status quo ante. That's precisely what Hamas is trying to break out of. And I think that Israel has yet to really unleash fully. They still have a number of options ahead of them. One is a limited ground operation in which they start to go after more of the rockets on the ground. They've already done a few commando raids into Gaza in this conflict. And so short of a full-on military occupation on the ground, they still have a number of graduated steps. But it seems that Hamas may welcome that at this point, at least some invasion that will allow them to kill some Israelis and thereby gain some political benefits within Palestinian politics. I think that Hamas is skeptical of Prime Minister Netanyahu's desire to come in. Netanyahu, for all his rhetoric, is a cautious when it comes to military matters, and Hamas reads this. And so Hamas is just playing by a different set of calculations. They believe that they can sustain much greater casualties than the Israelis can. They're probably right. And they also believe that Israel will not go all the way because, as Janine pointed out at the beginning of the show, Israel still wants Hamas there in order to enforce order over more radical groups.
I'm going to read a couple of online comments here before I go to your phone calls, which just show really the spread of views of this ongoing conflict. Sean writes, I'm getting real sick of Palestinian civilians getting killed, injured, or becoming dispossessed by Israeli airstrikes. Yes, Hamas rocket attacks are wrong, but will the Western world not hold Israel accountable for the high percentage of civilian deaths from Israeli airstrikes? According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, 77% of Palestinian deaths are civilians. And Beth writes, Hamas is known to hide weapons in schools, hospitals, mosques, as well as weapon launchers. One official in a video was even shown saying citizens should be willing to die. What kind of human would want to use innocent women, children, the elderly as shields? Israel is a sliver of land surrounded by those who want to wipe her off the face of the map. Are they supposed to sit and allow others to make this happen? Let me go to your calls. And we go first to you, Jack, and you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Michael. The assault of the Gaza Strip and the rocket responses triggered by the death of three Israeli teenagers. Prime Minister Netanyahu claims Hamas is responsible but offers no proof. It is therefore seems reasonable to assume that Israeli action is to decouple the unity government between Hamas and Fatah. We often hear the mantra that Israel has every right to defend itself, but what is missing in this narrative is the Palestinians' right to defend themselves from the Israeli military and settler terrorism. And Israel boasts that it has launched targeted strikes on Gaza, But when you see the death tolls, the numbers speak volumes.
Let me go to Janine on this, and I thank you for the call, Jack. I mean, this has been an argument from the beginning that these three young Israelis who were kidnapped and killed, sort of the catalyst to this, that there was no proof. Hamas never admitted culpability. They never denied it either, but, you know, it could have been a more extremist wing of Hamas or just individuals. We don't know, really, do we?
No, we don't, and it's quite puzzling. And, you know, I was talking to somebody from my old days as a reporter in the intel community, and I can't prove this. I don't have a second source on it, but he said the Israelis knew that the three teenagers were dead that first day. I don't know if Rob knows anything about this, which would mean, but they didn't want to tell the Israeli public right away. So if that's true, or I don't know, I mean, there's a good chance that's true. Israel went on its sweep of the West Bank anyway. It was a little bit opportunistic on their part to try and crack down even further on Hamas in the West Bank, rearresting people who were released as part of a deal that Israel had done with Hamas, mediated by the Egyptians. And you know, the question is, were there other alternatives as a response, right? Could Bibi Netanyahu have come out and said, this is a terrible murder, triple murder that has happened, but I'm going to work with Palestinian President Abbas to find the killers and get to the bottom of this.
Abbas did condemn it, of course.
He did, and that just was not welcomed enough in Israeli society. The truth is, the context for this is that the Fatah and the PA have done a wonderful job cracking down on Hamas in the West Bank, and it's been the quietest period, despite the terrible murders of the recent history.
But as anybody has gained from this, I suppose, Robert Dineen, it's the extreme left and the extreme right as far as Israel is concerned. And if anybody has lost in this, at least so far, and I'm talking politically, it's probably Abbas, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think President Abbas is the biggest loser so far. He had first come out and denounced the kidnapping of the three Israeli yeshiva students in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, no less, and did so in a way that invoked a great deal of Palestinian anger. What happened subsequent to that, you had demonstrations in the West Bank in which the Palestinian security services under Abbas came under pressure from Palestinian population. I was in Ramallah during demonstrations in which Palestinian demonstrations were taking place. Rocks were thrown at the Palestinian security services, accusing them of effectively being collaborators. I think, though, in understanding what's happening today, you know, we have a confluence of a few different crises that came together. I mean, when a plane crashes, it's because multiple systems break down at once, and to a certain extent, that's what's happened here. You had the events in the West Bank with the kidnapping of the three yeshiva students, the subsequent immolation and killing of the Palestinian boy from East Jerusalem. All this happened on one front. At the same time, you had a crisis brewing in Gaza in which you had Islamic Jihad firing low-grade missiles into southern Israel. All this came together then on a Friday in which all fronts started to heat up. Israel then hit a tunnel that was tunneled under Gaza into Israel. It killed six Hamas operatives inside the tunnel. Hamas was planning some sort of operation to kidnap either soldiers or Israeli civilians. At that point, Hamas said enough. We're now joining the fight, and where rockets are going in. Now, as I suggested earlier, Hamas was under a great deal of strain, both within Palestinian politics. It also felt that it was under strain. It had been hit very hard in the West Bank. It had said that it was not responsible for the killing of the three Israeli soldiers, three Israeli yeshiva students.
There was a statement to that effect from Hamas?
They had rejected that they had been culpability. The leadership rejected it. What seems to be the case is that you had Hamas operatives working within a general context of an environment in which they had the go-ahead to launch operations. But what Hamas is saying is we did not have direct operational control over what happened in the West Bank. You know, we may never get to the bottom of it. I mean, and similarly with you know, Janine pointed to the notion that that you had that the Israelis knew that that the three Israelis boys had been killed. That was their working assumption. I don't think they had conclusive evidence. At least that was the belief. But I was in Israel during the time while they were still looking for the boys. Everyone you talked to said, our working assumption is that the boys have been killed, but we have to pursue it.
Well, one of the renderings of that, excuse me, just for interrupting, Robert, but one of the renderings that I read suggested that those boys were being held. One made a cell call, and they were being held to essentially deal for prisoners that were being held by Israel. I mean, that would make a certain modicum of sense given what occurred in the last exchange.
My understanding is that the self call came immediately after they were abducted,
and then they shot them and killed them. Yeah,
that's right. And so that, in fact, no one thinks that they were held alive for very long, because the experience of Hamas operatives in the West Bank has been that you usually cannot trade with Israel from the West Bank, that Israeli intelligence penetration is just too great, and so you won't be able to last it out.
Let me bring some more callers in here, and we'll go next to Tahir. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. One of the commenters, I forget who it was, made a comment that it's not clear what Netanyahu's long-term strategy is, short-term thinker. And I tend to disagree with that, because to me what it looks like is, across party lines, is that the long-term strategy, if possible, is an Israel from Jordan to the sea, which is why you have the settler movement continuing, and why you have I was reading about in 2009, the Wall Street Journal, about Egypt brokering a truce between Hamas and Israel at that time. And we had these periodic attacks that served the opportunity of providing collective punishment to encourage out-migration. And I'd be curious to know, what is the out-migration? I know this is a little bit off-topic, perhaps, but what is the out-migration, and would this serve the interest of Israel in that respect?
Well, Zadine, I guess you were saying this is probably tactical on Benjamin Netanyahu's part, and the caller suggesting maybe in the long term he does have a plan here.
Well, if his status quo is strategy, then I guess I'm wrong, right? He wants status quo. You remember when John Edwards used to talk about two Americas back then? There's two Israels today. There's two Israels, right? You have West Bank, settler Israel, who wants to hold on to the land of Israel at all costs, right? And then you've got high-tech Kingdom of Tel Aviv Israel, which, by the way, Prime Minister Netanyahu brought here when he came to Northern California, right here to Mountain View, the Computer History Museum, in March, and tried to put that Israel up front. Now, that's the Israel he wants the world to see, and that's the Israel that he wants to guide into the future, I guess. But he's being dragged, or by his own party, his own choosing, his own political partners, into this other Israel. And, I mean, the caller's right that there haven't been signs that he really is willing to end the occupation, to think creatively, diplomatically, and then some of that has been the lack of progress on the Palestinian side and reconciling among themselves. But as I mentioned, and as Rob mentioned, there was potentially an opportunity there with that unity government.
And let me bring another caller on. And Wynn, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Thank you. You know, we've been hearing this since 1967, back and forth, all of these causes and effects. It seems to me, after listening to all these debates, that about our only hope for ever resolving this problem will be somebody like Sadat coming along and somebody like Rabin being willing to deal with him. And if we don't get those two together, I don't see how we're ever going to resolve this problem.
Yeah, two men who were assassinated, of course. But the leadership right now, I think, Robert Dineen, one could say is sorely lacking.
I think that'd be a gross understatement. Prior to coming to the council, I headed the Quartet office in Jerusalem. I was based out there from 2008 to 2010, and had the opportunity to get to know the leadership on both sides. And you know, I left Jerusalem really in despair, because I think what we really do see is a leadership deficit. I don't think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is even committed to a vision of greater Israel or of a one state. I think he's hostage to a right-wing government. He wants to survive tactically. I don't think he has a strategy. And you could say the same to a certain extent about his counterpart, President Mahmoud Abbas. He's playing a very weak hand. He wants to survive. He's very reluctant to take great political risks. And so you have two leaders who demonstrated in their negotiations brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry that they really were not willing to take the hard decisions, that survival, political survival, was much more important to them than taking the necessary risks for peace. And what we're seeing today is, to a certain extent, an outgrowth of that leadership vacuum. What you encounter you know, still in Israel, is a majority of Israelis willing to cede the West Bank and Gaza for genuine peace? I believe within the West Bank and Gaza, you have a majority of Palestinians willing to accept Israel genuinely in a peace agreement for a genuine Palestinian state. But neither of their leaderships are responsive to that those silent majorities. And so you really, at the end of the day, do have a tragic situation where both sides are desperately yearning for real leadership from their own people.
Well, a lot of the remarks that are coming in online and by email are highly critical of Israel. Let me just read a few of these. Peter writes, "Let's not forget that despite its rhetoric, Israel actually wants Hamas in power in Gaza. As the Israeli director of military intelligence, Amos Yadlin, told the U.S. ambassador back in 2007, Israel would be happy if Hamas took over Gaza because the Israeli Defense Forces could then deal with Gaza as a hostile state. Note, this is exactly what has happened." Another listener writes, "The fact is that the whole crisis was created by Netanyahu because of his objection to the unity between the Abbas government and Hamas, as well as to escape the pressure from Secretary of State John Kerry regarding the settlements. He exploited the killing of the Israeli kids as an excuse to criminally murder hundreds of innocent Palestinians, including children, as collective punishment." George writes, "Your guest Janine asserts that, quote, it is certainly difficult to sort through the different narratives. That's ludicrous. The history of fatalities and control is completely one-sided. Israel kills 100 or more for every Israeli killed, all the while building more permanent settlements in occupied lands and limiting the Palestinians' prospects." Janine?
Well, you know, it's more that what's been frustrating to watch, especially in this round, but you see this in all rounds, is that, and I dealt with this as a journalist for nearly two decades on this, is the two conflicting narratives of both sides, right? And there's often a lot of propaganda on each side, but the fact that each side can't, there's no nuance. You have to either say, Israel's under attack, doesn't matter what we're going to do, the whole world's going to be against us, we have to defend ourselves, Hamas wants our destruction, or we're occupied Palestinians and Israel's raining holy hell on us and world save us, right? And it's the same, you know, you have to sort through all of that. That's all I was trying to say.
And it keeps going through the same cyclicity over and over again with the ceasefire and then this beginning of violence and relentless violence that follows. Another listener writes, "I feel great frustration that the media continuously represents this as an equal conflict rather than telling the truth. One party is occupier, the other occupied. This is not an equal conflict. People of Gaza are living in what is now being called an open-air prison. Who benefits by continuing this distortion of the issue?" And Robert Dineen, you want to weigh in on that?
Look, it's a very this is an asymmetric conflict. There is an Israeli occupation of the West Bank. Israel did leave Gaza in 2005, although the international community did not deem it at the end of occupation because Israel still controls the airspace and the egress and entry points into Gaza, although there is one via Egypt as well. So, yes, this is an asymmetric conflict. But what we're seeing today is that, is that the Palestinians are not powerless, especially Hamas. There is the power of the weak, and that is what guerrilla warfare is based upon. And so Hamas is demonstrating quite impressively in certain ways that it has the wherewithal to strike Israel very deep into their territory, not only to import weapons from outside despite adverse circumstances, but to actually produce them as well. And now there is an indigenous capability production for medium-range rockets that even the closure of Gaza's borders hermetically would not prevent.
Well, we should also maybe bring in the role of American politics in this. I was remarking just yesterday about how American politicians have certainly also used this conflict to some degree. I mean, on both sides of the political aisle, Chris Christie was talking about President Obama not being decisive enough and consistent with Israel and the move to Iran and all of that showing not enough support for Israel. And Jane Harman, who is a strong Israeli supporter, talked about Palestinians hiding weapons and hitting militants in densely populated areas. That is, Israel's hitting those militants and targeting them as opposed to the Palestinians who are shooting rockets at whomever they might land on. Actually, you know, this is a catastrophe for both peoples, I think it's safe to say, and it's an ongoing catastrophe. And when it's going to end, this one, I don't think we know. Let me go to some more of your calls. We go to Colin next. Colin, you're on.
Good morning. Why is it that American politicians and American media seem so indifferent to violence against Palestinians committed by Israelis? For example, a Palestinian-American teenager, Tariq Kaider, was beaten by Israeli police after his cousin had been lynched by Israeli hooligans, and the photographs of his horribly beaten face were circulated across the international press. President Obama has said nothing, even though he was so quick to express his outrage over the murder of Trayvon Martin based on the illegal racial profiling.
I think Janine Zakaria would like to respond to your comments, Colin. Janine?
I think Margaret Sullivan at the New York Times said she got like 1,400 over 1,000 letters about the quote-unquote pro-Israel coverage in the New York Times. I mean, it's just that was covered. The fact that Palestinian-American team was horribly beaten was definitely covered. You had to be living under a rock if you didn't see coverage of that.
I'll be honest with you, you see more pictures in the New York Times of things that are happening to Palestinians than you do of rockets raining on Israel.
Right. I mean, because you have close to 200 people killed in there, right?
That's exactly right.
It's just that's what they're going to be the pictures of. So, you know, I think that this is this question of where the media is focusing and what they're doing and what they're covering and where and how they're biased. You know, foreign journalists are doing the best they can under, you know, in these circumstances. And I think they're trying to report both sides.
And we thank the caller. And
question, though.
Yeah, go ahead, Robert Denny.
On the specific question, however, the State Department issued a very strong denunciation of the holding and beating of the American Palestinian citizens. So it's just factually incorrect to say that the U.S. government did not react. So let's just stick with
facts. That's a good point.
Yeah, and we'll go to another caller in Nevada City. James, you're on. Hi.
Hi. You know, despite the irrefutable facts of Israel's barbaric treatment of a people criminalized for daring to exist, we're treated to a constant inversion of the truth, which holds that many and multiple depredations being suffered by the Palestinians do not amount to one of the most sustained and grievous crimes against humanity in history, but are the result of the Palestinians' intransigence and violence. This is a song of colonialism. The victims always bring it on themselves. If only they would learn to bear their chains in silence. Or as Golda Meir said, we cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children. And they're killing them right now while the world looks on again.
All right. I thank you for that call. Actually, what do you think about Netanyahu's statement? He said on Fox News on Sunday, I believe it was, that the Israelis use missiles to defend and protect civilians while Hamas is using civilians to protect their missiles. Robert Denine, I mean, it's been getting a lot of play because a lot of people feel that, especially pro-Israel people, feel that sums it up.
I think either side has a monopoly on righteousness here. This conflict, I've been involved in it for over 30 years, and when people resort to their own suffering and reject the suffering of the other side, then we don't make any headway. We have to, I think, view this as a tragic conflict between two peoples wanting the same territory. There's been a simple answer since at least 1937 when the Peel Commission viewed the situation of Arabs and Jews in Palestine that said, ultimately, these two people cannot get along together in one single state. There needs to be partition, two states for two peoples, and that's what we should be aiming for.
Yeah, but again, where's the leadership going to come from? I remember interviewing the Israeli novelist Amos Oz, and he said both sides know that this surgery has to take place, but no one has either the guts or the wherewithal to do the cutting or something to that effect.
Look, one thing that's interesting, and it's behind the headlines, that I find when I go to Israel now and I talk to people not from the left, but rather even from the center right, increasingly there is a view that's taken hold even within, I'd say, certain parts of the Likud party, although many of these people have left the Likud party, that recognizes Israel overreached in occupying the West Bank and trying to settle it and have it all, that Israel now is at a very dangerous inflection point for its own survival as a democratic and Jewish state, and that unless it rids itself of the occupation, Israel's future is imperiled. I think this is a sea change in perspective, and one can only hope, I only hope, that this change in perspective, again, not coming from the left, but coming from the right, that has come to adopt the left, what had been the formerly left view of the conflict, which is the conflict hurts Israel, then when that percolates up, hopefully that will lead to a political sea change. But ultimately, I think change will come when both sides recognize it in their self-interest to end it, to partition the land, and to share it.
All right, I want to read a couple more emails here. Joe writes, thanks for the program this morning. It seems to be a well-balanced and objective discussion, and the first discussion I've heard from the popular media critical of Israel. I know there are liberals, moderates, and extremists on both sides. I believe the only winners in this conflict now are the extremists, which does not bode well for a peaceful solution. You're nodding your head, Janine.
That's a good point, and I'm glad he thinks it's balanced. You know, I want to just say something, just pick up on what Rob said just quickly because it's important, and I really hope that Rob's right and there's going to be that sea change in the direction he mentioned. But there's another implication potentially here that Israelis generally are going to, or a conclusion they're going to reach, and namely that because the narrative goes like this, it's very simple. Ariel Sharon withdrew 8,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip in 2005, and we got rockets. Ehud Barak withdrew troops from South Lebanon in 2000, and we got rockets. Therefore, we cannot withdraw from territory in the West Bank because territory matters. And that's going to make it even harder to find leadership that's willing to do so.
Well, back to the conflict for just a moment, and Robert Dineen, we've got seconds left here, but Rick from Mill Valley writes, for those condemning Israel for civilian deaths, how do they recommend Israel counters rocket attacks given Hamas uses schools, mosques, hospitals, and homes as human shields?
Look, I can't speak for your caller, but again, look, you could criticize both sides for the way that they're behaving. I mean, Hamas is a guerrilla.
I think we have, actually.
Yeah, and, you know, they're employing classic guerrilla tactics that use every tool at their disposal, including hiding behind civilians. No one is pure here. Everyone has a lot of blood on their hands. It's a messy conflict, and it just, you know, I think pointing fingers at each other just doesn't get us very far, however justified it might be.
Well, I hope we can move forward in some way and at least see a ceasefire down the line, like Janine said, might happen sooner rather than later, and one that lasts. Thank you, Janine Zakaria.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Robert Dineen.
My pleasure.
And
thank
we also
you.
Want to thank Nawal Assad, the BBC correspondent who was with us earlier. And thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. And an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind about his book about his autistic son. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.